Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast. Today, we're going to focus on one of the busiest places in the hospital, and that is what goes on behind those doors that swing open to the emergency department. I have with me today Caitlin Williamson, who is the founder of The Right Atrium Nurse Consulting. She is a legal nurse consultant and expert witness in the field of emergency nursing, and she is well qualified, having earned her BS in nursing, her BS in psychology, a minor in Spanish, which you can imagine comes in handy. Mm-hmm. And she's a certified emergency nurse and a trauma certified registered nurse. She is working clinically now and is the mother of a couple of busy little kids and located in Michigan. Mm-hmm. She's also teaching other emergency nurses about basic life support, trauma certification, ENPC, and she will soon be a PALS instructor. Caitlin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Pat, so much for having me on today. It's a pleasure to be here.
And before we go into the topic, I wanted to clarify a couple of abbreviations, the ENPC and PALS, for those who are listening to the show who are not familiar with those.
So ENPC is Emergency Nursing Pediatric Course, and then TNCC is Trauma Nursing Process Course. Those classes are taken by all of the nurses in our department, just to make sure that we're thoroughly exposed to both the pediatric trauma as well as adult trauma.
And one of the unique aspects of working in the emergency department is you could have any age person. I think it's important for us to remember that, from the couple day old infant to the 100 plus geriatric patient, and they could come in with all kinds of conditions, medical, surgical, psychiatric, trauma related. It sounds like the series of certifications and skills that you have acquired would be very useful to you in dealing with such a diverse population.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the reasons I keep looking for those certifications and those classes, because we do see a variety of ages in the department. Honestly, we've seen even just newborn babies, minutes old sometimes, those come flying through the door, either delivered in the ambulance entrance or right inside of our resuscitation bay. So to be exposed to everything across the lifespan, it was really important to me just to make sure that I'm able to provide the most thorough care possible. And I love learning. So anything I can do to reinforce any type of learning that I'm doing is worth it to me.
You know, I've heard stories about babies being born in the car, in the parking lot, outside the emergency department. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine the amount of excitement that that would generate to have somebody who is delivering in a car or at the entrance to the ER or in the resuscitation bay, like, holy cow, guess what?
Yes. And actually, it's really funny. I've kind of come full circle. I was born in the emergency department in the resuscitation bay. I was barely able to make it. My mom says, she says I was almost an ambulance entrance delivery, but I was able to get in there. So I joke around with my coworkers that I've made it full circle, that I've returned to where I once was born. So.
Oh my goodness. I can't imagine the amount of adrenaline that was involved in that.
Yes. And the babies being born, I will say, are some of the most stressful things. And thank goodness that we have wonderful NICU and labor and delivery nurses, that they come right down and they do they're just amazing at what they do. And they just come out and they steal the show, and then they swoop them upstairs, and then they live happily ever after.
Yes. Well, we've talked about some of the aspects of working in the emergency department. What was the draw for you when you were thinking about the type of nursing that you wanted to be most involved in? What drew you to emergency nursing?
So anyone that knows me, they know that I love solving puzzles. I think emergency nursing is a wonderful puzzle, especially the triage aspect of it. And when I was first able to start triaging, I realized this is why I chose this. Emergency nursing, these patients come to you on what they think is the worst day of their life. So, and they don't know what's wrong, and we have to help them figure that out. So for me, just being able to be a part of that puzzle solving is amazing.
And I see the parallels immediately between solving puzzles in the ER and solving puzzles working for attorneys with medical records.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a huge parallel to that. When I first started looking through medical case files to try and figure out the cause or develop a timeline, I was like, this is what I do in triage. I'm mm-hmm. always trying to see what was the factors that started before this problem began, what else is associated with it, and then just trying to get those gears working to figure out what the source of the problem was or what the cause of the event was.
You're absolutely right. You're starting with a blank slate when somebody walks mm-hmm. through those doors. And I would think it can be very challenging because you're dealing with language barriers, with people who are mm-hmm. in pain, people who are not great historians, people who've got dementia. You are trying to put pieces of a puzzle together.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are very fortunate to have translators. We have both in-person translators as well as iPads and telephones to help us to communicate with our patients that come into the ER. We do have wonderful EMS as well that help provide a thorough history if they're able to get some type of family report there. But sometimes a patient will arrive and they will be confused. They do not speak English, and it's difficult to try and identify what language they speak. So we're just looking kind of at the overall picture to identify why are they here, and how are we going to treat this patient?
Mm. You just made me think about what that's like. You know, we can say to somebody in English, what language do you speak? And if they don't speak English, they have no idea what we're saying.
Right. Yeah. It's a total deer in the headlights kind of look, like, I'm not sure. And then if you can't identify that language, it's a whole nother problem. But thankfully, I've only seen that happen one time, and the family members came in almost immediately after, and they were able to assist in helping to figure out to get the appropriate translator for them.
Mm-hmm. I think of emergency department as an area that is occupied by a lot of people with trauma. I recognize you can have lots of patients with non-traumatic problems. Mm-hmm. What are the most common types of traumatic injuries that you see in the emergency department?
So I currently work in a level one trauma center, and I work in a large city in Michigan. So I do see a lot of penetrating trauma as well as blunt injuries. We have seen penetrating injuries just get dropped off by our ambulance entrance or at our front door, which would be like a gunshot wound or a stabbing. We do live by some major freeway. I do work at a hospital near some major freeways. So high-speed motor vehicle accidents we've seen and assaults as well. So I would say, you know, as far as my experience in the trauma center that I'm at, I see a wide variety. I've probably seen almost any type of trauma you can think of.
Mm-hmm. I'm struck by something that you just said. I had a vision of somebody pulling up to the ER, pushing the person out the car, saying, go in there, and roaring away. Is that something that happens, that people will be dropped off and then the car takes off? And if so, why does that scenario exist?
So that does happen sometimes. I would say, though, that for them to get out, to drive away, would be a little challenging because we do have police right there as well. But we do have patients that get dropped off right away. And 9 times out of 10, it's a gunshot wound that comes in. And it's really convenient. Our ambulance entrance is right next to our resuscitation bay. So it's just mere steps to getting into there and then having them immediately treated. But we do have police on scene and our security as well. So driving away is a little trickier to get out of our ambulance entrance. I imagine the design is probably intentional for that reason as well.
And in thinking about the kinds of trauma that you see, I know mm-hmm. that One of the challenges is trying to figure out what is the most pressing type of injury. We all learned the ABCs. I worked on a case involving a man who was struck by a car. He was a pedestrian. And the people in the ambulance put on a cervical collar. When he got to the ER, they checked his head for injury. They checked his thoracic spine and his lumbar spine, but somehow omitted scanning his cervical spine.
Oh,
now, you know the answer. You know the ending of the story, Caitlin, don't you?
I do, yes.
So he was in the OR. They were dealing with his fractured leg. Somewhere along the line, somebody took off his collar. And then when he woke up in the recovery room, he wasn't moving anything. He had a C1, C2 fracture. Mm-hmm. He ended up being a quadriplegic and lived for several years, ventilator dependent, on at home with his fiance, who became his wife. That's a rather dramatic example of missing a traumatic injury. Mm-hmm. Have you had situations like that, or are you aware of them in emergency nursing where a significant injury gets missed?
Yes. You know, and I think of neck injuries immediately. Sometimes we have patients that come in that are intoxicated, that have either fallen or been in a motor vehicle accident, and they'll say, oh, I have no neck pain, I don't need this collar on. And just making sure that they do keep that on, because that's considered, or they have a distracting injury as well too. So either being intoxicated or having a distracted injury and not realizing that they may have a cervical spine fracture. So we definitely try to mitigate all the risks in that way by appropriately putting on the collars in triage, even if EMS deemed it unnecessary in the field, but we find something upon assessment that makes us think there could be an injury. We have the authority, we have the autonomy to just put those on right in triage, let the providers know. And if they want to get a CAT scan from triage, they can do that immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And then some other risks of that would be, you know, we have sometimes patients that fall on blood thinners, that fall, hit their head on blood thinners. We can also get CAT scans in our triage bays as well, to make sure that there's no intracranial hemorrhage that they might decompensate from while waiting to be seen.
What about abdominal injuries? Do you ever see patients coming in, potentially they could have a lacerated liver or a lacerated spleen or ruptured organs of some kind that have the potential to get missed?
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes it happens. You know, I think one patient in particular, he came in at a moderate speed accident around 55 miles an hour. He was a restrained driver. The seatbelts went off and he said, you know, I'm fine. He was a little bit irritated that we had to get him, you know, undressed to make sure that there was no obvious signs of deformity. And we took off his shirt. We saw that he had the seatbelt sign and he had a little bit of pain to, you know, the right upper quadrant. He said, I'm fine. He said, I always have pain there. You know, sure enough, we did a CAT scan and we found that he did have a lacerated liver. Mm. So I think in triage, you know, making sure that we're undressing these patients, making, even if they say that they're fine, sometimes these patients don't know that there's something going on, obviously. So we have to be those eyes and ears to look for the missing pieces to see if there's something else that could be going on.
I have in my mind a picture that I saw in one of the cases that I worked on with a man who was a football player, well-built, but muscular. And he had a bruise across his abdomen. He was the only one in the car who was seatbelted. His buddies who were not, and there was alcohol involved in this accident, they were thrown out and they were killed, but he was restrained. He ended up being admitted to the hospital because of the pressure of the seatbelt had caused abdominal injuries. And I want to say he had, his duodenum and jejunum were involved in this because he had drains in that area and he'd had surgery to repair the injury. So you must see that fairly commonly. This is an auditory as well as a verbal podcast. I mean, auditory as well as a visual. We have this on our YouTube channel. So if you're listening to this on our audio channels, I will describe what I'm about to do. I've seen pictures, and Caitlin, you've seen it in reality, of people who have abrasions running down across their chest And then this guy who had the abdominal seatbelt injury, can you tell our listener or our viewer what this looks like in real life? Before we continue with the show, I'd like to share this special announcement with you. So much can go wrong in an emergency department. Would you be able to separate the bad outcomes from the medical malpractice events? My book, Analyzing Emergency Department Medical Malpractice Cases, focuses on one of the highest risk aspects of healthcare, emergency department care. That may be an issue in a personal injury case, a medical malpractice, or any other case in which a patient required emergency services. Do you understand the complexities of how the emergency department functions? This book will take you behind the doors of the ER to get a bird's eye view of what goes on. There are several aspects of emergency department care that make it high risk for errors. The unpredictable flow of patients, the constant pressure to quickly assess and treat patients, the lack of a previous relationship with the patient, and the huge variety of conditions and ages of patients. The public is increasingly aware of emergency department quality of care issues. Demand for emergency department services is increasing, and with it, cases against ER staff. In this book, you'll get an understanding of the roles and the responsibilities of the emergency department related to triaging, assessing, diagnosing, and treating emergency department patients. It highlights emergency department liability issues and provides vital content to help legal nurse consultants analyze an emergency department medical malpractice claim. Order it today at this link, http://lnc.tips/ed. That link again is http://lnc.tips/ed. Now let's return to the show.
The seatbelt sign is pretty distinct. It's pretty distinct when we see it. So, you know, depending on where you're sitting in the car, will depend on the areas that are being affected. So for the driver's seat, you'll see a strap sometimes, depending on the speed too, it'll be a bruise that goes across, or an abrasion that goes across right here, all the way across here. And then you also see, you can't see my lower abdomen from here, but you'll see some markings on the lower abdomen as well, indicating that they were indeed thrown forward and that the seatbelt had jerked them back. So usually there's some type of laceration or abrasion right here because of the sheer force of just being held backwards. But the bruising is almost immediate. And that's really concerning when it is immediate, because you're thinking, okay, there's obviously something going on inside, or something that's, you know, something that could be going on inside them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's mm-hmm. one of the important things about making sure that we are getting everybody undressed, do a full assessment of them, even if they're saying, I'm okay. Because sometimes they're shocked, they don't realize that there's something going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know you can have patients say to you, I'm feeling okay. And they're so overwhelmed with what has occurred that they're right. not able to pay attention to the signals.
Mm-hmm.
And that also raises issues as you're working as a legal nurse consultant, because the patient may deny symptoms in the ER and then go home and then start experiencing this delayed reaction of pain, and that creates some questions about, was the patient truly injured? Why was the person the next day saying she had pain when in the ER she said she didn't?
Mm-hmm.
That raises the eyebrows of attorneys.
Absolutely. And I think documenting proper discharge teaching as well, and doing discharge teaching very thoroughly after any type of trauma or any reason for coming to the ER, honestly, just to make sure those patients know what to look out for, when to return, and that it's very clear to them that they're able to verbalize it back to you when they should return to care if something's not progressing the way it should,
mm-hmm.
or if something else presents itself, especially after a car accident. Usually patients are so sore the next day. And we tell them sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it could be expected to be a little bit more sore, but if you're, you know, having, if you had a head injury and now you feel more nauseous and you're vomiting and you have a seizure, you know, we want you to come back immediately, call 911, you know, making sure that we're looking for signs of any type of head injury, mm-hmm. any type of head injury that might be a delay in presentation.
Mm-hmm. I've shared the story, I think, on this podcast of a young soccer player who was on one of the college campuses in our state. He was kicked in the head accidentally by one of his teammates and was sent to see the nurse practitioner on the campus, mm-hmm. who gave him all the appropriate instructions. You know, you need to go to the emergency department, be checked out. There was also a physician in the nurse practitioner's office who also told this young college student he should go to the ER and be checked out. He said, no, I'll be fine. And within about 2 days, he ended up with a significant bleed and a seizure and brain damage as a result of this. And he and his family sued the school nurse practitioner and the physician. I was involved in helping to defend this case because I was working with the assistant attorney generals, and this was a state college, and they defend state, local government, clinics, post office, mm-hmm. federal prisons. The judge dismissed this case after the plaintiff attorney put on the case and instructed this young man and his parents, you know, you've been given an offer to settle this case. You have chosen not to take the money. Have you changed your mind? He gave them an out. And then they maintained, no, they wanted to go on with the case. So then he dismissed the case and said, I feel that you received appropriate care and we're not going to proceed with this trial.
Wow.
I was in the room when this happened. The emotional reaction, I felt very sorry for this young man and his parents. I was tempted to go over and be the nurse, you know, and console them, but I was on the other side. I was on the defense side, and I knew I couldn't approach them. But it's exactly the scenario that you're describing. You've gotten instructions. Uh-huh. Do you understand them? Do you think that they're important? Do you follow them?
Yes.
He chose not to, and he paid such a huge price for that decision. You know, 18, 19-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I'm not going to go.
That's such a shame, too.
It is. You mentioned a little bit earlier when we were talking about communicating with people, you mentioned individuals who come in who are intoxicated. Mm-hmm. I have read lots of stories, and I worry about ER nurses when I read these stories of people who are abusive, violent, who take their anger or their drug side effects mm-hmm. out on the ER staff. Mm-hmm. What kinds of protections are in place for you? And is that something that you routinely encounter, or is that a rare situation?
You know, I would say it's a pretty common scenario to be in an environment. It's a common experience to be with sometimes with patients that are a little bit more agitated or aggressive, not necessarily violent to the point where anyone's concerned for their safety, but just to be encountered with someone who may be a little more verbal, in that regard. So we do encounter those patients. We have received training, couple classes to de-escalate situations. A lot of those tactics they do is more of a verbal de-escalation, trying to steer away from any type of physical or chemical restraint because of their obvious side effects that they can have on them. Mm-hmm. We have security presence as well in our emergency department, which are crucial to us. Even just sometimes having a security officer standing by while we're dealing with the aggressive patient can sometimes de-escalate the situation. However, at times it does increase the situation, escalate it if the patient doesn't respond well to that. So we have providers as well that come up to the triage area if that's an aggressive patient that doesn't want to be seen or something like that, and they'll speak to them. So we do have a couple ways to try and prevent any type of assault occurring in our department, which is great because I know the emergency nurses especially have been subjected to lots of types of violences, physical or verbal. So being able to decrease any type of risk for any of my coworkers, anybody, is important.
I did a podcast not long ago with Lisa Ortigo, who is a nursing administrator, and she said that every single day, every day of the week, there is somebody in her hospital system who's been assaulted by a patient or a family member.
Yeah. That's another thing to consider too, is family as well. Sometimes it's not the patient that's aggressive or hostile, it's the family members. And our patient advocates or inner security officers are great in having them removed from the situation if they're posing any threat to staff or the patient themselves.
Tell us about the patient advocates. What is the role of that person?
They do so many things. Their role cannot be understood. They are amazing to the department. They are such a great resource. They help facilitate getting patients home via cab transport. So sometimes they'll call insurance companies to have the patient get picked up by a cab. They come to all of our resuscitations. They serve kind of as a liaison. They provide support for the families that are in our waiting area when their family member is either in a trauma or a medical resuscitation. So they're that ear that they get to, the family leans on, and they are right there with them. They'll help them get water, they'll help them answer any questions that they might need. They also are able to help us with our patients in the department, either giving them, helping them figure out, their family members, being a communication point between their family members, especially during COVID when we had no visitors at one point. We had families calling, wanting to speak to family members. So they would be right there with a phone, helping facilitate communication between the both of them. So they cannot be understated. They are amazing.
Mm-hmm. I would think that would be enormously helpful.
Yes, they are. And the shelters as well, they help contact shelters for some of our patients that come in the emergency department. I think a lot of people think it's the lots of trauma and emergency medical complaints, but we also have a lot of social complaints as well. So they help bridge that gap with the social resources for the homeless shelters. Even just giving someone some clothes. Sometimes we have sets of clothes in our department that we're able to give them. And that's what they're looking for. So they're just right there ready to take complaints from family members and grievances, and they help our charge nurse work through those with the families or patients if there's something that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. I have a close colleague whose husband died at a fairly young age, and she was alone. He died on the night shift, and she desperately wanted somebody to come in and sit with her and explain what was happening. And the night nurses were all busy running. This was not in the ER. This was in a med-surg unit. That experience was so painful for her. She felt abandoned that she became an end-of-life doula, and she's now working with a hospital where her husband died to help change the environment so that other families don't experience what she went through.
How amazing. That is... That, and I'm sure that she has affected so many people in such a positive way by doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. We owe a lot to patient safety and the unfortunate people who pay the price that then helps to change the system to make it safer for everyone else. My husband and I go to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and they put in a very extensive patient safety program after a young mother lost her child. I believe her child might have been a year old, and there was a medication error that caused this child to die. And as part of the settlement, she said, "I don't want all this money. It's not going to bring my child back. What I want you to do is to take this money and turn it into a patient safety program." And that was what got Johns Hopkins really creating a solid program. I'm sure they had some programs in place before that, but that money made a huge difference and created lots of structure, lots of education, which is visible when you walk into the hospital or any of the doctor's offices. They have a screensaver on the monitor in the doctor's office, and it's continually playing safety patient tips. So you get to see while you're sitting there as family members, it runs in the background. And then when the physician comes in, it switches over to the patient's clinical record.
That is wonderful. And we get annual training as well. I would be so interested to hear about their program. I'm going to look into that after we get off of this, but we do get annual training on patient safety during our competencies. And, you know, we are always talking about how to position yourself safely, the proper, some scripting to see if how we can de-escalate a situation. And we talk about some other potential ways to help reduce any type of safety or violent concern.
Yeah, there are so many aspects of healthcare that involve patient safety and opportunities to do the right thing and opportunities for people to fall through the cracks.
It's just trying to identify those cracks and help fill them. That's all we can do.
That's true. The last question I wanted to ask you before I ask you how people can get in touch with you is, nurses have a lot of choices when they come out of their nursing program. What would you say to somebody who is considering going into emergency nursing?
So I would like to tell people emergency nursing is amazing. I love it. I think this is truly the field that I was meant to thrive in. But anyone that wants to look into emergency nursing, I think that you would benefit from shadowing in there. I think that the media and TV has kind of glamorized emergency nursing a little bit and emergency medicine in general. This seeing that, you know, every day is a trauma or every day is, you know, some adrenaline rush or something. And there are days that it is like that, that we do have trauma after trauma and there is an adrenaline rush after adrenaline rush. But after 5 years of being in the department, I will tell you that the adrenaline rush does fade. That, you know, we do see all these other patients as well that need care in the emergency department. We have patients that don't have primary care visits. We do a lot of prenatal stuff as well. We have a large population of patients that don't have any prenatal care. So we're helping education on there. So as much as there is trauma treatment and exciting, you know, treatment in the emergency department, we also have a lot of education. We have a lot of, you know, making sure that patients try not to come back to the emergency department. We urge them to follow up with their primary doctor to do urgent care if they're able to. So that way they are not waiting for, you know, a long ER visit for something that they could have seen at their primary care the next day. So I think the new nursing would benefit from doing a shadow at any type of emergency facility, just to see if it's the kind of rhythm that you're into, because it's extremely fast paced, which I love. I love doing something different every day. I love learning something new every day. Because you'll see all types of patients. And like you said, across all spectrums, you'll see babies all the way to end of life. And we do end of life care as well. So I think just be willing to learn a little bit about everything. Is what I would tell you to expect when you come to emergency medicine.
You're so right. As we talked about at the beginning, you have to be prepared for anything that might come through those doors.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Which is great. It's a great thing and it's exciting. And honestly, anything can walk in those doors. When you think you've seen it, something else will come in and just, I learn something new every day, which is one of the reasons why I think this is the perfect field for me, because I'm just continually being surprised and continually learning something new.
When I was a teenager, my mother was working as a nursing assistant in the emergency department, and then she became an LPN. And then I went to nursing school and she went to nursing school. And she would come home and tell me the stories of things that people did to themselves accidentally that I would just leave me shaking my head. One of my favorite memories is the person who was fly fishing and ended up getting a fish hook hooked into their neck. And this guy came into the ER. They had to be very careful. Think about all the structures that are in your neck. And you got this sharp barbed thing. You can't pull it out the wrong way. That was memorable.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that definitely stick with me when I think about some of the crazy things that I've seen. But also, you know, I think someone that comes new into emergency nursing to also have a good support system, because we do see a lot of tragedy as well. We see a lot. We are a part of amazing resuscitations. We're able to help literally bring people back to life, but sometimes we're not. And I think having a good support system within your own workforce and outside of your work is crucial to, I think, just even staying as an emergency room nurse. If you were to ask anybody that I work with, you know, why are you still here? I would say most of them would tell you because of the team that they're a part of, which is, my team is amazing. And I will honestly say that's one of the reasons I'm still there, is my team. And then the ability to make a difference in someone's life, truthfully, every day is such a blessing. And it's a really humbling experience.
Yes. Caitlin Williamson, who has come back to the place where she was born, working as an emergency department nurse and as a legal nurse consultant and expert witness. Mm-hmm. Tell our viewer or our listener how they can reach you, Caitlin, if they've got need for your services.
I am available on LinkedIn. You can find me. My name is spelled Kaitlynn. And my last name is Williamson. It's Williamson. I also have my company, The Right Atrium, with Right being spelled Write, on LinkedIn as well. I do have Facebook, and I will be working on my website coming soon.
All right. Wonderful. Thank you, Caitlin. I appreciate you sharing your stories, giving us a little flavor, just a little flavor of what it's like to walk into the emergency department and put in a shift, not knowing who's going to be coming, what needs they have, working as part of a team, being able to quickly triage people, perhaps encountering language or mentation barriers that make it difficult to figure out what is going on with that person. You mentioned dealing with gunshot wounds and trauma and the importance of not missing the diagnosis, particularly for trauma. I know that some of our listeners may be thinking about some of the more common issues like misdiagnosing an MI that can have pretty tragic consequences, or missing a diagnosis of meningitis in a child, or missing some type of a traumatic injury, as I shared, focusing on the fractured legs instead of the broken neck, and what impact that had on that gentleman's course. Lots of things for us to think about and many complexities. I applaud you for working in such a high-paced environment and enjoying it.
I do. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
And to you who's been watching this show, be sure to come back next week. We'll have a new guest, new topic. Go to podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. Check out the bundles of podcasts that we have and their accompanying workbooks. We've divided our topics into expertise, marketing, client relationships, finance, and business development. And you can get a best of the best shows and the workbooks to help carry you through those shows to make sure that you've paid attention to and absorb the major points in those podcasts. You'll find those at podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Karen Taylor and I have been talking about her experiences as a legal nurse consultant, getting a business started in the midst of a pandemic. Karen, what are some of the highlights of what we covered in your podcast?
Well, we covered the trials and tribulations of trying to start a business in the midst of a pandemic, which presents a lot of challenges. Discussed how I was open to new opportunities that came my way, that I was able to get some of my own attorney clients, but also opened myself up to subcontracting and the success I've had there. and also gave some tips to new legal nurse consultants getting into the business, some things that they may want to consider and think about, and also the value of utilizing social media for not only networking, but for building your business and getting work in the legal nurse consulting world.
And Karen has, in her podcast, shared how she uses social media in a very specific way that I know you're going to want to pay attention to. An easily available tool that has brought her work as well as given her exposure to her potential audience. Be sure to watch Karen Taylor's podcast on Legal Nurse Podcast and get the tips that she's going to share in her show.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.